Is It Funny? Episode 3. The Goons, mostly, but especially Spike Milligan. As a scholar of medieval history, I can tell you there's no beginning and no end. that sounds a little bit more apocalyptic given our current circumstances, but what I want to say there is we make rough approximations all the time in history, and nobody thinks twice about it. So when I say I teach medieval literature, I teach a variety of things from around the year 500 to around the year 1500, which is, of course, 1,000 years of literature, while some of my colleagues teach a decade. But I'm not bitter much. So when we're talking about the roots of comedy and where comedy has come from and gone to, it's hard to really say, oh, there's a beginning point of what we would think of as sort of modern comedy and many places that we could point to as the start of it. But for the particular comedy that I've been talking about that has influenced me and has been a particular obsession with me since I was a teenager, one of the starting points certainly is The Goons. The other day, talking on Twitter with De Servelange, I'm not sure of the real name, but then I never know people's real names anyway, I just know their Twitter handles. But we were talking about, again, the connection between the Beatles and the Goons by the way of producer George Martin. And it's hard to imagine a less likely collaboration than the very patrician George Martin with his training in classical music and the Beatles, these, you know, young musicians from Liverpool. And the connection, of course, was the Goons, in addition to all of the classical work that George Martin had done. He also produced the Goons, produced their records and recordings. And so that was something that probably gave him an end to seeing a different point of view from most of the record producers who had all turned the Beatles down back in the day, still ruining those days, I'm sure. And that connection to the Goons and the Beatles having a little more confidence in working with this very different sort of person, this very patrician voice. And again, it's still true to a certain extent that in Britain, especially in England, that your accent determines a lot of the ways that people react to you. And so reacting to this accent that George Martin had and that mellifluous voice, probably it gave them a lot of comfort when they found out, oh, he's the one who works with the Goons. And despite the sometimes reserved nature of him, that there was that recognition and connection to that kind of anarchic comedy that they really appreciated. In fact, when he said to the Beatles in the studio, you know, please let me know if there's anything you don't like. And of course, George Harrison, the funny one, said, well, for one, I don't like that tie. And that set them off on the right foot. And that's, you know, made them feel more comfortable. When you feel like you can share a sense of humor, that really helps. And the Goons are there in a lot of the history of the comedy people that I'm going to be talking about and have talked about. Certainly the Monty Python crew, who were all mostly in school at that time and were, like all other young comedy fans at the time, obsessing about the show. Because, again, the real difference between our modern consumption of media and what was true in, you know, back in the mid-20th century, so long ago, was hearing things once and trying to remember them. I remember, you know, Mondays in school talking about the Monty Python episode that was on Friday night and trying to remember all the things from it. And people who know me know I have a terrible inability to remember anything quite exact. So I'm always getting things just a little bit wrong and misremembering them and repeating the misremembered bit to myself over and over and over. So the Pythons, Peter Cook also, he would tell stories of claiming to be ill and having to go to the infirmary because there was a radio in the infirmary and he could hear the Goons on the radio on the weekends. And this was, you know, here was someone so inspired by this kind of the style of comedy and this very what seemed very new and very innovative, that he was writing and selling sketches by the age of 18. So it had a profound impact on him. Now, the Goons as a group were originally four. Spike Milligan, of course, who did the majority of the writing for it. Michael Benteen, who only lasted for, I think, one series. Peter Sellers, who's probably the best known member of the Goons internationally. And Harry Secombe, who was actually one of the people there at the start, too. In fact, what the Goons came out of was their military experience during the war. Spike Milligan, of course, was already interested in sort of showbiz because he was a jazz player. He was a jazz trumpeter. But, of course, everybody gets called up for the war, and he had a very hard time conforming to the life of the war. In fact, the story they told of Spike Milligan first meeting Harry Secombe was that Spike was responsible for losing a large artillery gun, and it rolled down a hill and very nearly flattened the tent where the radio operators, including Harry Secombe, were. And allegedly, anyway, you know, these stories, who knows if they're true or if it's just what everybody told so many times that they certainly believed it. But it certainly fits that Milligan came in and asked, had anyone seen a gun roll by? And it was Harry Secombe who said, what color was it? And so clearly, people who were meant to be together and meant to hit it off. And Peter Sellers, who had a chameleon ability to inhabit a number of characters, worked perfectly. Michael Benteen, less so. His humor had an overlap with the sort of anarchic aspects of the Goons, the rest of the Goons, but his style was somewhat different, and they parted ways. There was some disagreement, too, with Spike Milligan, who certainly was very glad to be, well, glad to be, that's probably misstating it, but was very excited about being the one to primarily write all the scripts. And although in the early years, because of the weekly pace and the amount of writing that took, he actually wrote with other writers, most notably probably Eric Sykes, who's very well known comedy writer in general, and Larry Stevens, whose daughter has just put out a book about his life. They did a Kickstarter last year, and unfortunately, I haven't read it yet because I had it sent to Dundee, assuming I would be there months ago, and I'm still here in New York. Actually, one way to sort of shoehorn in at least one amazing woman into this talk, because this is all mostly men. Beryl Virtue, who went on to become one of the most influential producers in British television, was originally the office manager for Associated London Scripts, which was the sort of writers' cooperative that Spike Milligan put together with Eric Sykes and Larry Stevens, eventually Galton and Simpson, who are probably best known as the writers for Hancock, but of course wrote many, many, many wonderful shows. And yes, I'll talk about them sometime later too. The Goon shows were anarchic, wild, crazy. They seldom made any sense. There are lots of very sort of standard old jokes in them, but wrapped up in this very crazy, fast-paced, unpredictable, and almost surreal kinds of humor. And while they dealt with some of the familiar things, and of course coming out of army life and being in the immediate post-war era, there was a lot to do with the army. In fact, sometimes there's too much, I think, to do with military life. But also just other things that simply came up crazy. There was a wide variety of things that they ended up sort of throwing into shows completely unpredictably, with strange and unexpected movements, strange and unexpected things. Probably my favorite title of all the Goon shows, the dreaded batter pudding hurler of Bexhill-on-Sea, gives you an idea of the kind of surrealist combinations of things, and the returning characters that the live audience really just, you know, would cheer every time they would hear that voice. Of course, Peter Sellers' Blue Bottle. And no, I won't try to do any of these voices. even though, again, random thought, one of the surprising places they show up, Elton John, Captain Fantastic, and the Brown Dirt Cowboy, the comic book that was included in the original LP. I don't know if they reproduced it for CDs, but it also sort of the story of how Elton and Bernie worked together and wrote their songs and became famous. there's a part where Elton John talks about doing his goon voices. And so these were things that were really embedded in the culture, and that people knew these very bizarre characters only through the audio, through the sound. And the sound was an important part of it too. The sound was really innovative. There's all kinds of like very, very strange sounds. There's an oyster, a Fred the Oyster. That's just an incredible, very complicated sound. If you go to the Wikipedia page for the Goons, you can hear that recording. But there's all kinds of exaggerated sounds that add to sort of the picture you form. I mean, this is part of all radio drama comedy, but they came up with very astounding ones. Spike was apparently very fascinated with all of the sounds in the sound effects library, and so would come up with unusual ones to employ in the show. And then there's also just the concepts that became very embedded in culture. Lurgy. A lot of people who use the term lurgy to talk about an illness, being sick, you know, having a cold and all the ugh, that you're sneezing and spitting and choking on. Lurgy comes from the Goon Show. There's running jokes as well as running characters. The pianos, people always end up hiding in pianos or actually being sort of shut up in pianos. And that was one of the jokes that I think to this day my brothers and I still repeat to each other. What are you doing in that piano? I'm hiding. it's a very silly joke, but one that certainly I can appreciate. But it's this combination of the surrealistic nature of the humor, that it didn't have to fit into these normal sort of components of comedy shows. And if you think of something more like later, Round the Horn, where you had a format to it, it changed a lot. And I love Round the Horn, and I think there's a lot of really great things about it, but it had a format, it stuck to the format. And the Goon Show was much less about the idea of format and sticking to it, and jokes that didn't necessarily make sense, and just coming to a full stop because you'd run out of ideas. And there's a really great, this is a passage from Humphrey Carpenter's biography of Spike Milligan. And this is Alan Simpson of Simpson, Galton and Simpson, talking about how Spike wrote. And so the shows ended up having kind of the style in which he wrote. And this is the quote. Spike used to do everything straight onto the typewriter. He used to hammer it out, and he couldn't bear to stop for 5 minutes to think. So he'd type away and get through 20 pages, and that would be a Goon Show. And then he'd start from scratch again. He'd do 5 or 6 drafts of each show, and when, for instance, he couldn't think of anything else for Eccles to say, he'd just put fuck off or bollocks, and then he'd go back later and fill that in. And you used to hear his typewriter clacking away. He never stopped. Whereas someone could go past our office and wonder if there's anyone in there. If you open the door, you might see Ray with his pipe and me on the floor, both of us thinking of the next line. And sometimes it would be hours before we'd type one line. A huge difference. And again, I'll probably do another episode or maybe a couple, just about Spike himself and sort of his struggles also with mental illness and how that figured into it. And Galton and Simpson, too, are very clear about sort of the difference between when he was sort of on and when he was kind of depressed, and he would just lock himself away and then just pop back when you know, the episode had passed. So it was innovative stylistically. It was innovative in a comedy sense. It's still trafficked in a lot of the sort of what we'd think of as kind of the old-fashioned humor, racist stuff, and both with Africans, with colonial people, even though Spike Milligan himself was born in India, but very Irish. And nonetheless, the music on the Goon Show was provided by Ray Ellington, who was actually the son of Harry Pitts Brown. Actually, Ray Ellington's real name is Harry Pitts Brown, too. But his father was a music hall performer and comedian. And oddly enough, but he died when Ray Ellington was very young. And his mother raised him. And his mother, Eva Rosenthal, was an Orthodox Jew. So she raised him an Orthodox Jew. So he's early on this jazz musician in London and gets the job with the Goons. Because of, again, people who just sort of know each other. And he ends up being a performer on there. And this is, I mean, for the 1950s, because it was mostly the decade of the 50s. It was a very surprising thing, even though some of the parts he played too were a little, they would be very offensive now. And this is, I mean, this is the case with a lot of comedy of the past. And, you know, unlike a lot of, you know, I don't want to say, John Cleese, for example, who are like, oh, you just can't say anything or you offend anybody. It's like, well, no, they shouldn't have been funny back then. And they certainly aren't funny now when people are like, oh, no, this is really offensive. And instead, like, well, maybe you could just try to be a little more creative instead of falling back on these old crutches. But that's just me.
Well, obviously, there's a lot more to say about Spike. There's actually a lot more to say about the Goons, too, maybe some specific episodes. But for Spike, I certainly want to talk about Pakun. Probably not so much Korean Chips, although, you know, again, a very interesting sort of attempt to do something different. And, of course, his war books, which ended up being very popular, Adolf Hitler and My Part in His Downfall. The Q series, which, again, was still innovative and is sort of like, while Monty Python was happening, Q was happening. It was around the same time. But you could see where the support for Monty Python was there. And Q was kind of like, okay, we've given Spike Milligan a chance to do this thing. And it's like, we're not sure what he's doing. And, of course, his poetry as well, which is very much in the style of Edward Lear. But I feel like I've blathered on enough for this episode. I want to try and keep these short. So I will see you next time. Bye.